Hey, everybody, thank you so much for listening to this episode of the Preacher Boys podcast. I make this show for you, and I hope that you really enjoy it. I have a lot of people that ask me how they can support the show financially, and you can do that by heading over to patreon.com/preacherboys. You're going to get access to exclusive content, including early releases of episodes. I've got a couple episodes right now that have been released at least a month early over on Patreon. You've got access to things like unique merch, depending on what tier you join, and you get access to some behind the scenes content that I'm posting within the group. So head over to patreon.com/preacherboys and become a member over there today. Every single supporter helps make this show a little bit more possible, especially as I continue to add additional episodes and content every single week. Thank you so much for tuning in. Let's get back to the show.
Trigger warning. This podcast contains descriptions of various abusive situations. Listener discretion is advised. You are listening to the Preacher Boys podcast, a podcast shedding light on decades of mental, physical, and sexual abuse within the independent fundamental Baptist movement. The testimonies shared on this podcast are told from the personal experience and perspective of the survivors. Not all legal outcomes are known or final. Any suspect is presumed innocent until proven guilty in the court of law. To find more information about the Preacher Boys podcast and upcoming documentary, visit PreacherBoysDoc.com or connect on Facebook, Instagram, or Twitter with the handle @PreacherBoysDoc. Now, here is your host, Eric Skwarzynski.
All right, Carter, thank you so much for joining me on the Preacher Boys podcast. I really appreciate you joining me on the show. Can you just introduce yourself personally and let people know a little bit about you?
Sure, no problem. Well, first, thanks for having me. My name's Carter. I did go to New Beginnings Girls Academy for 2 years, from July 13th, 2007 to July 21st, 2009. And did a lot of activism work for a number of years. Kind of jumped out of it as I did transition to male a number of years ago when I, like, down the road after everything had changed physically, it was different to bring that up. So right. My activism just kind of dropped because when I would tell people, hey, you know, by the way, I went to New Beginnings Girls Academy, then it was coming out twice. One is a survivor of a more or less bullshit environment, and the other is it, like, confusing them. How could you go to a girls academy in the first place? Right. So just kind of got weird and I stopped doing it, but these places didn't stop. And it's a little bit more than just my story. There's a whole bunch of people. And after I got out for a number of years, I just wasn't okay. And I would think about what they were doing at certain times. It just never kind of passed. So Until these places shut, then even if it's uncomfortable, it's probably something that needs to be done to prevent other people from having those lifelong effects that that place had on me. So,
right.
But no, I just want to, oh, I'm sorry.
Oh, sorry. No, it's fine.
But my biggest part of my story, I never want to be seen as a victim still. I was a victim. My victim experience was, like, I believe it was 769 days. But after that, I was a survivor. So my story, if it's sad and stuff like that, that's just is what it is. I'm a survivor, not a victim. So
that's awesome. Yeah. I think that's I think that's really cool to have that mindset. And you know, it's not easy always to look at these kind of situations that way. But I know that's going to be encouraging to a lot of people who've been in similar situations. Now I know when we talked beforehand, you said you were at the New Beginnings Girls Academy from 2007 to 2009. Can you just tell me, was this something that was in your religious upbringing? Like, did you have a religious upbringing? Was it, you know, just coincidence that you ended up at an IFB reform school? Like, what was kind of the trajectory that landed you there?
Well, to be honest, I grew up in a heavily religious childhood, but it wasn't like normal religion. It was the most far out we could do a story just on that, but basically it was more or less a cult. This guy came from, like, Sioux Falls, South Dakota to a place where I'm from, not South Dakota, but he moved this whole group of people to the area I'm from, in the South, and they just all started their own group. There was no church or no police officers, cops, law enforcement, like, all that was non-existent. Everyone was born at home. Religion was, like, breathed into us. And it wasn't like standard religion. It was some stuff that I pulled out from. So it was just trippy. But we did have like a pretty solid connection between us, because it was really only us. And how my mom even found out about the home was I had a family member that was a captain of a police department. And I don't know how he found out about it, but he recommended it. And my mom just went with it. But I've not really ever asked him if he knew about what had gone on there. I think if he did, especially as a captain, he never would have recommended that stuff. But that's the long version of my religious background.
Right. So if you're comfortable sharing, what was the mindset that they had when sending you there? Was it something where,
why I got sent there? I was struggling. Like, when I hit puberty, I just kind of really had a hard time with everything. And I never even knew what transgender was. That was a thing, like, because of the way I grew up, I didn't even know it existed. So, and I mean, I never got to wear pants either. So I just could never figure out what it was. I was just like a loner. I was by myself. Right. And there was a lot of stuff that happened in my childhood that was horrible, really terrible abuse. And I thought people knew, but no one did anything. And that just kind of, it really just turned me. And between the abuse and the puberty hitting, I just didn't want to be there. Every year when I was like 8 and 9 years old, I was like, next year I will be big enough to run away. I'm going to run away next year. Mm-hmm. And every year I wasn't big enough until the year I was big enough. And then it was on. I disappeared for a long time. And essentially, I mean, I wasn't doing bad stuff. I wasn't like doing drugs or anything. I never tried drugs as a child. Like, up until 18 years old, I tried pot one time at 18 years old. So like, I never did bad stuff. I was basically a traumatized kid that had a bunch of stuff happen. And my only solution, the only way I could feel right, was to just run. And when I ran, I found a little family. I worked for my babysat to cover my housing there. Like, I just started living at a really young age. And of course, my mom, she was getting in trouble for me not being in school, and they were worried about me and stuff like that. So to them, putting me at New Beginnings with their advertising, like, I don't blame her. The advertising looked great. It looked like they were going to patch our family together and really get me on the right track. And that's just not what happened.
Right. So I mean, you obviously talked about, you said it was an uncle that recommended it?
No, it was just
a friend of the family.
No, a family member that's a captain of a police department.
Got it. Okay,
I don't want to go too further than that.
Right. So you mentioned, like, if he knew what went on there, he probably wouldn't have recommended it. So obviously, that raises the question for those who don't know about the New Beginnings Girls Academy, like, what did go on there? And when you hear about these reform schools, a lot of times people brush off these stories because, hey, it's tough love or it's this. But when you start digging in, there's a lot of these stories that go deeper than that. So can you talk a little bit about what you saw at the New Beginnings Girls Academy that, did unsettle you and did, add to the trauma? Because it seems like there was a lot more going on than just, strict discipline at the school.
I really couldn't tell you everything because we'd be here for over 200 years. Wow. Maybe not that long. We'd be here for over 2 years, though, because I saw over 2 years of abuse. Like, every day it was something. It got to the point where it was just normal. And, I mean, I can really only tell you the things that really stood out to me, the things that essentially messed me up in the end, things I thought about and what took the longest to heal over were certain things. But they also prepared me for what I did as a career down the road. So, but the things that really stood out, the stuff that took me a long time to heal, was like what I saw happen to those girls and what happened to me. Just like for years I would hear like the screams, like, and it just messed me up. Like, I saw a girl that like a lot of the girls, they would try to hurt themselves to get out, because in most programs you get bait corrected. But it wasn't like that at this place. And I saw girls literally just cut so bad, like to the point, like, there's just lots of blood and like deep, deep damage. And now, like, my last job was working at a mental hospital, and I saw that stuff at the hospital. I watched people get stitched up, and that's what should have happened to the girls. But instead, they would do something called a JCMT, what was it? I think it was like juvenile crisis management technique, where they would hold us down on the floor by pressure points with an adult on each limb. So they would hit your pressure points in your arm, and that would be the whole adult on just that one arm. And then you had one on the other one, and then on your legs. And like, I would try to knock myself out because the pain was just so immense. Like, you could not bear it. It hurt. Like, your hips were digging into the tile. Like, it was just terrible. So I would try to knock myself out so I wouldn't feel it anymore. And then that didn't work. Right. Then they would just be sitting on my head. But I mean, that in itself, that's not a real move. When I worked at the mental hospital, like, if we would have one even put a patient on the floor like that, that would have been abuse of a vulnerable individual. Like, the things they did was illegal. Like, they kidnapped me, basically. They took me across the state lines. My mom did not know they were putting me in Missouri. When she signed up, she thought we were going to be staying in Florida. But they held me in that room. They took me off my medications. I went in on, I believe it was 3 different medications, and they just crashed me right off of it. They said I didn't need medication. I needed Jesus. And I was 16. Wow, my memory's like, it's been a while, but I was 16 years old with PTSD. Like, yes, I needed medication. I was not totally reliant on Jesus. That was like the load of shit right there. And I remember crashing off of that stuff. Like, it was terrible. And I remember one time, like, right when I was new, I was still in Florida at this time because they only kept me in Florida for 6 days, but I sat straight up in my bed from like a dream or whatever, because I still have that, but I just sat up, and then I about knocked myself out on the bunk above me. I still remember the dang of me hitting my forehead on those bars. Like, like, it's like I went through some shit coming off that stuff, and it wasn't even like, I mean, I don't know. It's the most crazy shit ever. And they, I think, like, what set me off to be one of the less favorite kids that went through that program was when I went in. I still remember what I was wearing. I was wearing a red shirt and carpenter jeans and like those brown construction boots. I was like, all ready to be like a total grown up, like go to work and shit. But instead I got dropped off there, and I remember McNamara was sitting there with his fat ass talking about, we want the same things you want. And he said my name at the time, and I was like, I'll never forget. I looked him straight in his face. And I was like, really, you're telling me you want gay marriage too? And like, that was not what he was thinking. And that's, apparently we didn't want the same things in life. Cause like, that started out a terrible stay for me. Their main focus for me and for a couple others, but I felt like mostly me, was homophobic statements. Like, I remember like a couple, or like a year later when I was in the cafeteria, and he was like, running around screaming, get right with God, and like throwing tomatoes at us. And I was in trouble as usual. I was on discipline, so I was basically standing on the wall, which is just facing the wall like other people have mentioned, where you stand there for like insane amounts of times every day for a week until you've been good enough to get off of it. If you weren't good enough, then you're still on it again. Sometimes you're just on it if they feel like you're not right with God. But I was on the wall, and he was screaming and throwing tomatoes, and he got like right in my face like a drill sergeant. I remember he was spitting on me while he was screaming, and he was talking about, I would never let another girl lay lips on me and things like that. And like, for years when I got out of there, like before I transitioned, when I did identify as lesbian, because it just is what it was, I was literally afraid to hold my girlfriend's hand in public, because like, I just didn't ever feel like, it's not that I was ashamed of it, but I just never wanted to experience that again. And I was scared, like, to experience something like that again. So I just was afraid to be open in public. And that's actually something that still kind of happens. Like, even now that I've transitioned and no one would ever guess anything, I'm just nervous. I just never want those negative experiences that I had in the past with those kind of people. And this was like ultimately the best way to get away from it. Although that's definitely not why I transitioned. That was one of the upsides. But I'm just like, the stuff that happened there, if I would have done even a couple of those things during my employment as a mental health professional, I would be in prison today. And they did that to children. That's where I'm like, I do not understand. Our justice system has failed us. But these monsters are still out on the street. And there have been girls that have died after that home because of the impact that it had on their lives, where they just weren't the same and they turned to drugs or had accidents because right. they were to self-medicate. It's like, mm-hmm. it's really hard. You don't want to go to a doctor and talk about what happened because it's just so far out there. Like, technically we'll all be on medications for the rest of our lives.
Right. And there's no, I mean, when you're trying to talk to somebody about it, there's really not a common ground to say, like, you know what I'm talking about, right? Like, you're talking about, you know, I'm talking about like one of these troubled girls' homes, and people are going to look at you with a blank stare, like, what is that? And so, it's definitely not an easy thing to find common ground on. So you talked a little bit about the culture of, you know, the New Beginnings. And you mentioned it was kind of from, you know, right off the bat, things were pretty negative with the experience there. I'm always curious because, and I had someone else who was on the show and they kind of shared the breakdown of like the range of people that were there because, you know,
There was a wide range. There was like right. all different colors, and there was all different backgrounds. Like, we had like missionaries, kids, and like, high up military officials, their kids were there. Like it really just, there was all kinds of people, but the ones that stood out to me the most were, the kids that had clearly had sexual abuse and they were there. You could just see, like, they would be made fun of for like having accidents, but they were scared to go to the bathroom. Like, that kind of stuff where you, I don't know, maybe I was just more sensitive to it, but I could always pick up on that stuff, and they had a hard time for sure.
Right. Right. Did you feel like there were any undertones of like sexual abuse within the school?
I never saw it, obviously. It never happened to me, but there were weird things, like just really weird. Like, I remember one time when he was preaching, he was like, everyone bow your head. And he was like, raise your hand if you're a virgin. I'm like, why the hell does this guy need to know that? And then like there was other times where he would set people up. Like, he wore these outrageously skinny khakis, and he was like a big dude. Like, he needed like at least three sizes up, and he would sit with his legs like way spread. And like, I never looked at that stuff, and I still don't. It's just, you know, like, not what you want to do, but like, it was hard to miss that. And then whenever you'd even look in his direction, he never accused me of it, but he accused other people of it, talking about, oh, you're looking at my stuff, I'm a married man, you're a sinner, praise God. Just weird stuff. He had a huge emphasis on sexual things, and like, he would bust in the dorm. There's many times that he would go in there and just throw our beds off, essentially flip our dorm, throw everything out of the closet. We'd go in, and what little possessions we had, it would be just in the floor, broken sometimes, mixed with everyone else's stuff. It's like your whole life, that's all you have, and it's just thrown on the floor because he said he could, quote, smell sin in the camp, aka masturbation. Yeah. I'm like, these are girls going through puberty, like, what the hell do you expect?
Right, like, and
it was just uncomfortable.
So you mentioned, you know, obviously he's a, you know, he was married. Was his wife heavily involved with the school as well, or was it mainly him?
Yeah. Mm-mm. It was both of them, although she was a little bit nicer. It was the same. I mean, she's just as guilty. You can't be a part of that and not be a part of it at the same time.
Right. And how many staff were there within the home? And how many students, would you say?
I mean, it has been a number of years. I can name the staff. Let's see. Heather, Laura, the Max, that's two. They had a daughter, Cassie, that's one. And then they had another daughter that was married, so that's two more. That's seven I can think of.
Okay.
Then there was CT, their brother, or Max, the man's brother. So like eight. I've even talked to people after that. I'm like, why the hell didn't we just overrun them? We could have just ran upstairs and got their guns and just like defended ourselves or done something. Like, in hindsight, there was at any given time at least 30. Like, that would be really, really conservative. Mm. More like 40 something, because there was two dorms. There was a dorm right under the Max's house, which that was more of the, not the better, but like the less likely to run. Like, there was a reason that they were not high risk, and they were in the basement under the house. And then the people like me that would run on a dime. We were upstairs above the school where it was locked and things like that. They definitely, that was one thing. They should, if anything, if they never face charges for anything, they should face charges for false imprisonment, because they literally locked us in and we weren't allowed to exercise. I still have like marks and stuff from that, because I was a athlete growing up. Like, I always just ran around everywhere. And so I had like muscles and stuff. And then from being like locked like that, everything just kind of went down, because I didn't get to like do any of that stuff. And now I have like stretch marks on my legs. It's embarrassing, but it's like, it's literal scars from that stuff. Just from inactivity. And like, it's not like I wasn't being inactive. We were reading Bibles and being beat with religion. Our schedule is pretty full. Like, one thing about them is they did keep us really busy, like between school and prayer and having to memorize like whole sections of the Bible at a time and quote it word for word, or we'd be on discipline, things like that. Just like, it was just out there.
Right. And what would you say? Well, actually, one thing I wanted to hit on. So you mentioned guns. So they were armed?
Oh yeah. I remember, okay. I could not tell you what kind of guns they were, but there was rifles and shotguns for sure. Like, I remember seeing the gun case. It was like this wooden framed thing with glass in front of it, and it had guns in it. I remember that it was near the top of the stairs. Only a handful of times I got to go up to their house, and I remember that very clearly, because I remember looking at it like,
Yeah, a little odd.
I like guns anyway, but like in hindsight, I'm like, why didn't I just run up and kick the glass, grab the gun, and start? But, you know, maybe their ammo wasn't kept with it. You never know.
Right. So, you know, obviously, like, there was a lot of psychological, spiritual abuse, and you mentioned a little bit of the physical abuse. It seems like everyone's had a different level of that, depending on, you know, what time period they stayed, or, you know, when they were there. So I'm curious, what level of physical abuse did you see? Was it mainly just being like restrained? Was it, you know, SWATs?
I'll tell you all of it. It's not all of it. Obviously, it was 2 years, and there's stuff I'm just not going to remember because of the blackouts, but that's what I had originally gone to tell you when I talked about that girl. She got held. We'd get held in the JCMT, that particular girl that cut herself really bad. They poured 3 bottles of alcohol on her, and that's where I remember the screams from. Like, those were the screams that I had to try to block out for, like, years. Because, like, that, when it's that deep, you're not going to pour alcohol on it. That was just punishment. And, like, certain things, like, I had a medical issue, and I had to have, a procedure done, and they told them no pain meds, and they did it while I was awake, things like that. Like, it was excruciatingly painful. And I mean, where did the pills go? Like, I was never in there for drug abuse. Like, why could I not have medication to help with that? Like, I never ever had a desire to do drugs, much less did drugs. So it's just things like that. Other things, let's see, physical abuse as far as locking us in the dorms, doing the stuff with the medication, taking the alcohol whenever there was incidents like that. This was a weird one, but like, if you literally didn't dot an I or cross a T, that would be counted as one. Like, one T missed, that's one. You miss the I again, that's two. And if you got, I believe it was like 10 or more, then you were cheating in your pace, because you had to like score it or grade it yourself or whatever. Right. And your first offense, it was like not as bad, but every time they did that, it would get worse and worse. So like, you'd have to write like 1,000 sentences on character or integrity or whatever the word was. And it'd be like multiple words in that sentence. And then you have to write it 1,000 times as your first offense, and then 2,000, 3,000, 4,000. Like, on top of maintaining your Bible study, quoting the scripture, all that. Like, it was insane. And then the worst part of that is they'd make you do an hour. It started an hour, and then it'd be like 2 hours, 3 hours, 4 hours as the offenses kept recurring. But they would make us get on the floor. on our knees and hands and put our ankles over, you know, cross the ankles behind us and literally scrub the floor with a dry toothbrush, that one little piece of grout, for an entire hour. Like, my knees would be killing me. And that was, like, just the first offense with the words and all that stuff that you had to write. And it was right. just, like, it was stuff like that. Or they make us do jumping jacks, which, I mean, that's not really abuse. But, like, when you make someone do 1,000 jumping jacks in the dead heat of the sun, like, yeah. We're not right. in the military. We weren't grown. Like, that was excessive. But, I mean, jumping jacks weren't the worst. I kind of liked them. But I'm a weirdo. I liked them compared to other stuff we'd have to yeah, do over there, like, for sure. to say the least.
Was there anybody there, like, I mean, obviously you were probably restricted in how much you were able to talk about, you know, why everyone was there, but
yeah.
was there, you know, obviously now you're working, you know, you've mentioned, like, working with, you know, in a mental institution, you know, working mm-hmm. in law enforcement a little bit, like... Yeah. Looking at it through that lens, was there anybody there where you thought or you think, like, maybe they did need, like, the tough environment of a reform school? Or was it something where, you know, you looked around and thought, like, why are any of us here? You know, because, and again, I'm not asking, just to be very clear, like, I'm not saying that, you know, should these places exist? I'm just saying, like, there is... You know, some people may listen and say, well, obviously for someone like you, that wasn't the right place. But was there someone that, you know, something like that would be good for? Because I know that was the big thing when I was growing up, is like we'd have people come in from places like this. And the way it's portrayed is like these are the most dangerous, you know, some of the most dangerous people you can imagine. And they're, you know, we send them off here and then we reform them with like tough love and discipline. And you know, it's basically boot camp. And, you know, but then you hear these stories and you're like, I'm like, I just can't, especially as a parent now, I just can't imagine something where I would feel comfortable sending my kid away for a year to essentially like pause everything in their life and, you know, be tortured for a year and a half, you know? Like, I just can't...
I didn't see anyone there that would qualify for needing
even if it was ran correctly,
yeah,
there wasn't a need, right?
Well, I mean, there were... Okay, if they could have had the most successful program ever, if they would have taken the same group of us and, like, actually loved us like they said they did and, like, positively worked with us... That would have done a total 360 or 180, whatever. I was not good at math. That would have turned a lot of lives around. It would have been
right.
much different than now, where you have hundreds of people that have spoken up over the years talking about, you cannot, like, literally, it doesn't make sense in my head. You can't have that many people saying this stuff happened and it still not be believed. Like, this stuff right, did exactly. happen. These stories are legit. We really did experience
this. Yeah, there's entire support groups for people yeah. that went to the exact same experience, have the same nightmares, have the same... you know, memories. Yeah. Was there a period, because, I mean, you're there for, like, almost 3 years. Actually, yeah, a little over 2 years.
It was, like, 2 years and a month. I yeah. did the math one time, like, years ago. It was, like, 769 days.
Right. So that's a long time to be sitting under the same kind of preaching, same kind of, you know, attitude, whatever you want to call it. Was there ever a period where you started, like, thinking... Are they right, you know, or were you started buying to the system they were laying out?
Absolutely not. I'll tell you one thing about me. There was always one thought that I always had, and it did not matter what was happening to me. It was, I will get out of here. I will turn 18. You will not break me. And that last part, you will not break me, that was something I would repeat to myself over and over and over. No matter what was happening in my head, I would say, you will not break me. Because they tried to, essentially, they tried to, and I never fully bought into their bullshit. Like, I did start, you know, obviously I'm reading my Bible 24/7, and I'm going through hell on earth, and the Bible's talking about, like, you know, positive stuff. It's the Bible, so, like, it was nice to kind of, like, try to get away in my head, think about the outside, or... You know, the Bible, I did start, you know, Psalm 23, I'll walk through the valley of the shadow of death, I'll fear no evil. Like,
right.
I used to think of those scriptures because I was in the middle of that. Like, so right. I did turn, I mean, I'm not religious now, but at that time when that was my only option, I did find a little bit of comfort in the Bible verses that gave me hope on things ending, because that's all I really had was a number, 18. I'm going to turn 18 one day, and these people cannot hold me. I will go home. I will see my family. And, like, that was another thing while I was there. They always, always, always said, your family doesn't want you. They don't love you. Why do you think we have you? And almost like Hitler, you say a lie long enough, loud enough, and often enough, people will believe it. We started to believe that we weren't wanted, because how can you drop me off, let them take me halfway across the country, and me not believe that you didn't want me, when that's all they tell me for my entire stay is you didn't want me? And like my mom, like other people, they got visits at 6 months and stuff. My mom was a single mom working a business that she started herself, a very hands-on, humble business, trying to support me and my sibling. And it's like, she didn't have the financial means to come see me. Like, I know she was paying the bills because my dad had passed away and there was Social Security from that. And it was like, there was sufficient money for the program, but my mom also had other stuff. She had to work. So I knew she was paying the bills and I knew she was paying for the program, but they always said, oh, your mom doesn't even pay. So like, I mean, after listening to that, sometimes I started to wonder, like, I'm not getting to see my mom. I know she's struggling. I watched her work till her hands bled. Like, I knew she was working, but then she wasn't seeing me. It was really confusing even talking about it now. Like, I had a hard time wrapping my head around it, because like there's this one time, like I think I'd been there for like it was like a little over a year, I believe, and I hadn't got my 6 months visit, I hadn't got my year visit, hadn't seen my mom, and I was once again in trouble. I was on the wall, because it was really easy to get in trouble, like super easy. Like, I'm picky, and if you didn't eat all your food, 3 demerits right there, and like if you couldn't finish it the next meal, another 3 demerits, and then you only have 4 demerits left and you're in trouble. Like,
yeah.
And it could be being like mine, 1 demerit, disrespecting a sister, 3 demerits. like,
right.
Some of them were good rules. Okay, I see we need to order, but excessive, like, just because there was minor problems, then all of a sudden you're standing in quarter for a week and you're denied, like, even more than you were already denied. So, anyways, back to that particular event. I was on the wall in discipline, and Mac was like, McNamara. I refuse to call him Brother Mac, even though sometimes it slips. But Mac was, he was like, what would you do if your mom came to see you? And I looked at him and I was like, I'd run the first chance I got. And he was like, cancel the visit, call the mom and cancel the visit. And I still remember like how bad that hurt. Like, I just cried, like all day I cried, like the deepest cry I've probably ever cried in my life. It was like, it was just, it hurt me to my soul. Like, even when my dad passed away, like, he had committed suicide and stuff. Like, I never, ever cried like I cried that day. Like, even to this day, like, over all the things that I've lost in my life, I've never cried like that. Right. It's just like, it's just the fucked up mentality. The way that they fucking tried to get in our heads and make us feel like we weren't even worth it. It was like, it's just bullshit, because it wasn't until probably about last year where I actually could talk to my mom about that. And she said, what are you talking about? I was never coming to visit you. Because like I said, she had business. My mom struggled. My dad left her with a lot of debt. My mom, I mean, I think it was not till like recently that she was able to clear all that stuff in the last several years. But like, my mom was busting her ass while they were over there just disrespecting her, taking her money and turning us against each other. Like, maybe not her against me, but me against her for sure. Like, you can't just sit there and go through that stuff day in and day out and eventually not start to wonder, well, I really am here because she doesn't want me. Like, I don't know. It really messed up my head. But the pain that I felt that day, it just stuck with me. And that was another reminder how much I hate those bastards. Like, that's what I thought in my head. I'm just like, fuck them. I'm going to make it. Fuck them. And I used to do stuff to remind myself, like, I was going to age out. We used to have to write our initials on, like, our underwear and our outfits and stuff. And instead of writing my initials, I started writing 17 on everything. Because I knew if I wrote 18, obviously, they're going to take it away. And I can't do that. So I beat the system by putting 17. All my clothes are marked with 17. And every outfit I put on, every time I got dressed, it was a reminder to myself, I would turn 18. I would get out of there and they would not have control of me anymore. So that was one of my subtle ways that I kind of was like, fuck you every day to them. And like other things too, like when I went in, I had a really big, I almost gave it away where I'm from. But anyway, I had a really big sports team, like a college team t-shirt. And I loved that shirt because I knew it was a male t-shirt. They didn't know that. And I used to wear that thing to bed every single night because it was like the only thing left. Like, and then eventually they took that too. But for the time that I had it, it was something that was just like another fuck you to them, another reminder to myself that I would get out of there. And I don't know, I didn't realize until like the last couple months that 17 was a legal age. If I would have succeeded in running away, I would have been free. And it's like, just the mind control, like, how are you going to take me to a state where I could be legal at 17? And I didn't know that. I didn't even know where I was on a map. Like,
right.
It was crazy. Just the whole thing about that is crazy. But ultimately, like I said, when I talk about this stuff, sometimes I feel like a victim. I was a victim, but I'm a survivor, and I used all that shit that happened to me to try to help other people. We've successfully talked other survivors out of suicide, out of depressive episodes, all kinds of stuff, just because we have such a tight bond. You can't go through that shit. Like, I'm not even – honestly, I can't even give you a complete picture because there's so much stuff that I'm missing. And, like, unless you were actually there, you would just never know what it actually was like to be there. And there's – that was when I turned to these girls, and we became, like, tight. Like, over the years, like, I've met out with – hung out with a couple of them. And even when we weren't able to hang out, like, through, you know, Messenger or whatever, like, we still have a support system. Like, this week I contacted another member that actually did a show on here, and I talked to her, and, like when I'm depressed or I'm going through stuff, I call the other survivors because at the end of the day, they're only ones that are going to know without me even having to talk about it. Cause if you're going through something, you want to address that, but then you have to bring up with someone else. You have to bring up, well, why it happened, what happened. And you're not going to be able to really get the help because you're like triggered again by talking about that other stuff. So it's just, it doesn't work. That's why we have our survivors. That's why we're so strong. That's why, no matter how many years go by, we still stay together.
Right. Oh, that's awesome. Yeah. So did your eventual leaving, was that when you turned 18 then? That was basically the minute you turned 18, you were out.
No.
No.
No, I was scared to say that I wanted to go home because, okay, so the first year I was like, fuck these guys, and I did my own thing and I wouldn't go with the program. Then I was like, damn, okay, I got to roll with the program to kind of ease up on the suffering. So I started like following their rules and like freaking praying for people and like really rolling with the religious bullshit. And I don't feel like it was faking it because I was actively trying. Like, I literally prayed. I'm like, God, please don't make me gay. Please take this gayness away. Like, please fix me so I can, you know, be normal and like have a good time. Like,
right.
Please fix me. And God never fixed me. That wasn't my struggle. Like, I fully believe I went through all this stuff for a reason.
Right.
And nothing was wrong with me. At the end of the day, who I liked or loved, that did not make me a bad person. That did not make that place need it. Like, two girls kissing is not the biggest problem out there. Like, that was where I was at with it. So, I kind of started rolling with the program, and then I went from being a prisoner to a guard, essentially, because they selected several of us that had really been rolling with the program, and they made us helpers. So we were essentially junior staff, and we were responsible for writing the other girls up. And it's like, our demerits, like, got cut down. We could only get 5 demerits instead of 10.
Right.
And so, like, it was hard, and I tried to be fair, but sometimes, like, and this was something I had to deal with after I got out, but sometimes I just really had to, like, write certain people up. And I would get in trouble if I didn't write enough people up. So kind of the easiest way to do that was to see who was acting out the most and then just write them up a couple times, whatever I could write them up for, just to kind of fill my book. And I would just do that. And it's like, it really sucked, but it was my job. Like, and if I didn't do it, I was in more trouble than they were. Right. So it just sucked. Like, I feel bad. I still feel bad that I had to do stuff that made other people have a harder stay, like as far as being on discipline and stuff. But at the end of the day, I'm like, well, they would have done the same thing, and I don't feel too bad about it, because at the end of the day, we were all just survivors trying to survive. Sometimes certain things were required that in an ideal situation we wouldn't have wanted to do. So,
right.
But I mean, like I said, that stuff prepared me, like writing people up, paying attention, doing my rounds, all that stuff. Like, I learned how to like do that kind of thing, and then I was able down the road to actually have a career where I actually helped people using some of the stuff that I've learned. I know what it feels like to be locked up. I know what it feels like to miss your family and be going through depression or PTSD. Like, that stuff I can relate to, and that's why I loved working in mental health so much. It was just, of course, I never ever told my patients at the mental hospital like anything about me, because we're focused on their stay and not my story. But the story did help, and there were times I was able to do stuff at the hospital that a lot of people would have froze up at, but I didn't freeze up, because I'd already seen it at like 16 years old. I'd already seen somebody bleeding out. I'd already seen, like, you know, crisis situations, like, as a kid. So, of course, as an adult, when it's my job to go in there and make sure that you come out okay, like, it just wasn't even an issue. It was just no problem at all. But, like I said, it took me a long time to be okay, like a really long time. I went through a lot of depression, a lot of drinking at certain times, like when I was younger, not so much anymore, but like it took me a long time. And even with my family, like, we weren't good. I didn't have contact with my family for a number of years, because I had a hard time with all that stuff afterwards. And then even my mom did, like, I had to cut her a break. She was coming out of some religious stuff herself. And that's part of it. Like, yeah, I have like websites up where I shared my story, and I talked about my mom didn't care because she didn't love me and things like that. And I'm not going to say that I regret that, but at the time that I wrote that, that's what I believed. And that was what I believed from my experience there. Like, and so part of that, like, you know, I'm thankful that things have changed with my family. I have a great family, a really, really good family. And now I have a great support system, but it's taken almost, what, like 10 years to get that?
Right.
Like, it's been a long time.
So I'm curious, and I think you kind of, you know, usually ask what's been helpful through the recovery process, and it seems like the community aspect has been huge. But I'm curious what you would say to someone, just kind of wrapping up, I'm curious what you would say to someone who, you know, maybe is in a similar position to where you were, and maybe is in a experience where, you know, they're seeing the same horrific stuff that you were experiencing. Like, what would you say to encourage someone, or maybe have been through it and they're on the other side now? Like, what is an encouraging word you would say to other survivors and fighters that are going through this stuff?
I would say absolutely do not give up. There's a reason we went through this shit. Life is not fair, and I don't think these places should have existed, but the fact that we made it through, we made it, and we're survivors, like, I would say never give up. Like, every depressing, suicidal thought you have, like, those are just aftermaths of an intense, like, emotional earthquake that happened to you. Like, everything will pass. There are people that do love you. You're not unwanted. And things do get better. Sometimes it takes a long time. But there are people that get it. There are people that can move forward. And, like, ironically, marijuana was something that helped me. I got it legally. I was able to never take antidepressants and only smoke, or, you know, consume it with the various different ways. That was something that helped me, but some people are allergic. I do not encourage illegally using anything. If it's legal, I would say, you know, talk to a doctor if you've tried everything and it hasn't worked. But ultimately, I would tell those people, like, we can come together, we can share our stories, and we can shut these places down. And at the end of the day, that's my goal. That's the only reason I share my story at all, is in hopes of either helping someone that's went through this or raising awareness so no more kids go to those places. And like, I would really like laws to change to criminally persecute or prosecute, whatever, not persecute, I use the wrong word, but prosecute the people that are responsible for causing so many people to hurt. Like, and there have been literal deaths. And I mean, I was there when people died. Like, It's just, lives have been lost through this, and this is a fight for lives, so we can't give up on it.
Right. And I guess lastly, what would you say to someone who, is maybe considering sending their child to a place like this? Obviously what you've said, I think, should be compelling enough reason not to, but what would you say or recommend to people who think this is their only option?
I would say it's not your only option. There are a lot of other state regulated programs where they are required to follow the law. The fact that place exists is just another sign of a system that's failed us. The fact that the separation of church and state is that extreme that those places can exist. But I would say there's a lot of other options. I know kids are frustrating and people go through stuff, and mental illness, that's a hard thing to handle. Like, If you have a family member going through that, but there are so many other options besides this one. Like, and I would say also my sister pointed out to my mom these news articles when I was in there. My mom did not believe them. She thought that they were people that were upset because of how positive our story or my letter sounded and all that, because of how I was required to write that stuff. Another thing we haven't even got into, it's like I said, it's couldn't fit 2 years into this podcast, but I mean, we're not making this stuff up. No one is making this stuff up. This stuff did happen. It does exist. And there are so many other options. And if you're just not, like, I would say, like, if you and your kid, you just cannot get along, nothing has worked, and there was absolutely nothing left, I would never suggest this, but the foster care system compared to those programs, the kid would be better off just like that than foster care is not a good thing. I'm not suggesting giving your kid up, but I'm saying, like, if it came down to that, that would even be better than the freaking home. It was terrible. Like, I mean, it is what it is, but there's a lot of hope. There's a lot of options. There's a lot of people that will be willing to help. And that's what our goal is at the end of the day. So.
Right. That's awesome. Well, thank you so much for joining me on the show and sharing your story. I mean, it means a lot to me, and I know it's going to mean a lot to the people who listen to it. And I think I think you're the third person now who's come out about this home. And, you know, Bill McNamara and his wife are still, you know, running a home in Missouri for men only right now. But it's pretty stunning that they're still doing, you know, what they're doing, even though there's so many that are coming out and speaking out. I was just going to say thank you for adding your voice to that. I really appreciate that.
Oh, no problem. And I wanted to say, when New Beginnings shut, they didn't actually shut. What they did, which is what I've seen happen in other cases, they just took all those girls. Maybe a couple of them got to go home, but the other ones, they just got redispersed into other facilities, just like New Beginnings. Mm-hmm. They literally just moved states and changed names. Like, New Beginnings might not have a girls or a boys home right now, but it doesn't mean that those children are safe. Those children were just relocated. And that is our mission, to find every kid and shut those people down.
Right. Oh, that's awesome. No, I think that's really important to keep in mind. And it is, you see that happen over and over and over again. Thank you for speaking out. And I'm thankful to get to play a part in getting the story out as well. And I'm hoping that you're not the last one that we get to have on and share your experience. So. But thank you for joining me. Thank you for sharing, and thank you for just doing everything you're doing, and for being open about it.
All right, I appreciate it, and thank you for having me today. I appreciate it.
Absolutely. All right, thank you.
All right. No problem. Bye.
All righty. Bye-bye.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply. When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.